not do the work. I had been solving problems like some overzealous superhero when I was really supposed to help other people solve problems. My job was to flow the work to my team and keep it there. It is an embarrassingly simple idea, but for me, as a newly promoted manager, it was a startling realization. In my executive coaching, I'm frequently surprised at how many senior leaders and even executives haven't discovered this simple lesson. When managers take it back, not only do they end up doing all the work, but they rob others of the opportunity to use and extend their own intelligence. They stunt the growth of intelligence around them. They begin to slide down the slippery slope of the accidental diminisher. Whether accidental or not, diminishers are costly to organizations. They might be superstars themselves, but they quickly become the boundary factor that limits the growth of their organizations. The cost of the micromanager is that organizations cannot grow beyond them and struggle to leverage the other intellect inside the organization. Micromanagers don't use the full complement of talent, intellect, and resourcefulness available to them. So these capacities sit idle in their organizations. To counteract this, they continue to ask the organization for more resources, wondering why people aren't more productive and are always letting them down. In contrast to this, investors not only engage people through clearly delegating responsibilities to them, they extend assignments that stretch the thinking and the capability of the individuals in the team. They grow the assets in their portfolio. As a result, they get full leverage out of their current resources, and they stretch and increase the capacity of the organization to take on the next responsibility. The serial multiplier. After 7 hours of conversation in a studio apartment next to one of Mumbai's slums, Narayana Murthy and 6 of his friends agreed to a vision for a software firm in Bangalore that they hoped would do 2 things. First, persuade their wives to each contribute $250 as seed money. Second, garner respect around the world. They accomplished both. Their investment of intellectual energy and financial capital turned out to be very sound, as Mr. Murthy led Infosys Technologies from its tiny beginnings to become the first Indian company to be listed on the NASDAQ with a valuation of $10 billion. Murthy helped his team reach beyond their dreams, encouraged India's entrepreneurs to believe in themselves, and gave a face to the new India. He became a revered name inside and outside the company. The Economist ranked him among the 10 most admired global business leaders in 2005. He could have easily stayed at the top and enjoyed the fame and power of his exalted position. Instead, on his 60th birthday, Narayana Murthy stepped aside as CEO. No crisis triggered the move, and there had been no power play to topple him. The move was the extension of a deliberate plan. He had spent years investing in the other co-founders so they could operate independently of him. Consistent with his plan, he handed the role of CEO over to one of the other co-founders, Nandan Nilekani, and Murthy stayed on as non-executive chairman and chief mentor of the company, a role he has performed for 10 years. Infosys has continued to grow its market value, $32 billion as of November 2016. Asked at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, why he chose that role for himself, Murthy said his primary role as a leader was to ensure successive generations of leaders. When asked what drives him to invest in this way, he said without hesitation, "The reward for winning a pinball game is to get a chance to play the next one." In other words, he doesn't crave the spotlight of being CEO as much as he hungers to freely invest again elsewhere. While some CEOs are addicted to praise, this leader is addicted to growing other people. A multiplier to his core, he recognized that his greatest value was not in his intelligence, but in how he invested his intelligence in others. And now, in his second career, he has again been investing in the growth of others, just with a much broader sphere of influence. Free from the operational management responsibilities at Infosys, Murthy has gone on to invest in governments and institutions around the world, including Thailand and the United Nations, and educational entities like Cornell University, the Wharton School of Business, and Singapore Management University. He has the ear of the Prime Minister of India and is making a case to him to invest in the next generation. In his words, "We have to put young people in charge of these massive educational initiatives." And his investor approach to management has established a pattern at Infosys. When leaders like Narayana Murthy invest in the development of other leaders, they earn the right to step away without jeopardizing the performance of the organization. The investor not only reaps these rewards, but is now available to repeat the investment cycle elsewhere. Much like a serial entrepreneur who builds one successful company after another, these leaders can become serial multipliers. Of course, doing so requires the leader to break free of the addiction to praise that entraps many senior leaders and instead become addicted to growth, growth of the business, and growth of the people around them. Serial multipliers grow intelligent. This intelligence isn't ephemeral, fleeing when the multiplier is no longer by their side. It is real, and it is sustainable, which is what allows the multiplier to replicate the effect again and again. Becoming an investor. To become a serial multiplier or a serial entrepreneur, you have to have a starting point and a first success to begin the positively addictive cycle. Here are four strategies for becoming an investor. The starting block. Experiment number one, give 51% of the vote. When you delegate, you probably let people know what you are expecting of them. Take this to the next level and let people know that they, not you, are in charge and accountable. Tell them how you will stay engaged and support them, but that they remain in charge. Give them a number to make it concrete. For example, tell them they have 51% of the vote and you have only 49%. Or be bold and make it a 75-25 split. Give them charge of something that requires them to stretch beyond their current capabilities. Start with ownership for the current scope of their role and then take it up one level. Look for ways to up-level their responsibility and give them a job that they aren't yet fully qualified for. Experiment number two, let nature take its course. Nature is the most powerful teacher. We can easily forget this when consequences are artificially imposed on us. But we remember and learn deeply when we experience the natural consequences of our actions. Letting nature teach is hard because our managerial performance instincts kick in. We want to ensure that our team delivers successfully. The good news is that you don't need to let a major project fail. Find the smaller waves that will provide natural teaching moments without catastrophic outcomes. To let nature teach, try these steps. Number one, let it happen. Don't jump in and fix an assignment so it doesn't fail. Don't take over a meeting because someone isn't handling it well. Let the person experience a degree of failure. Number two, talk about it. Be available to help someone learn from the failure. Be standing by after a failed meeting or lost sales deal to help them get up, brush off the sand, and talk about what happened. Ask great questions and avoid the ever-diminishing, "I told you so." Number three, focus on next time. Help them find a way to be successful next time. Give them a way out and a path forward. If they've just botched an important sales call, ask them how they'll handle a similar situation with another customer in their pipeline. Not only are there natural consequences to our mistakes, there are natural consequences to good decisions. Allow people to experience the full force of their successes. Step out of the way, give them credit, and let them reap the full benefits of their victories. Experiment number three, ask for the FIX. Many people are promoted into management positions because they're natural problem solvers. So when someone brings you a problem, it is only natural for you to want to fix it. And chances are, people expect you to because you so often do. In that split second before you respond, recall Carrie Patterson marching into the office of his intern and demanding she do more than just point out awkward sentences. Ask for people to complete the thought process and provide a fix. Use simple questions such as these. What solutions do you see to this problem? How would you propose we solve this? What would you like to do to fix this? Most importantly, don't assume responsibility for fixing the problem. Put the problem back on their desk and encourage them to stretch further. When someone brings you an AWK, ask for an FIX. Experiment number 4. Give it back. When someone is stuck and asks you for your opinion, it can be hard not to take over. For some, the tendency to take over is so great that they sit on their hands, afraid to speak out lest it turn into a hostile takeover. When you see your team member struggling, offer help, but have an exit plan. A conversation can happen anywhere, in a conference room, one-on-one in your office, during a spontaneous meeting in the hallway. Regardless of the venue, visualize the point in the conversation where you symbolically give the pen back. Imagine yourself at the whiteboard, adding a few ideas to the collective thinking on the board. You finish your thought, and then hand the pen back. This gesture lets your colleagues know that they are still in the lead and are accountable to finish the job. Here are some statements that signal that you are handing back the pen. I'm happy to help think this through, but I'm still looking to you to lead this going forward. You are still the lead on this. I'm here to back you up. What do you need from me as you lead this? Each of these is a simple entry point, but done repetitively, these actions can instigate the multiplier effect inside your organization. The multiplier effect. When multipliers invest resources and confidence in other people and give them ownership of their success, they uncover the vast intelligence and capability that lies within. Muhammad Yunus, 2006 Nobel laureate and father of the microcredit movement, said, "Each person has tremendous potential. She or he alone can influence the lives of others within communities, nations, within and beyond his or her own time." Multipliers invest in others in a way that builds independence to allow others to apply their full intelligence to the work at hand, and also to expand their scope and influence. The independence they create in others also allows the investor to reinvest over and over, becoming a serial multiplier. The math is simple, but powerful. The immediate multiplier effect is that multipliers get, on average, twice the capability from someone they lead. When extrapolated across an average organization of average size, approximately 50 people, that's the equivalent of adding an additional 50 people. Repeated over potentially 10 different leadership roles over the course of a career, that is an additional 500 people. Multipliers continually double the size of their workforce for free. This 2x return in perpetuity for leading like a multiplier makes a compelling business case, even to the most discerning investors on Sandhill Road. Chapter 6 Summary. The Micromanager versus the Investor. Micromanagers manage every detail in a way that creates dependence on the leader and their presence for the organization to perform. Investors give other people the investment and ownership they need to produce results independent of the leader. The three practices of the investor. Number 1, define ownership. Name the lead. Give ownership for the end goal. Stretch the role. Number 2, invest resources. Teach and coach. Provide backup. Number 3, hold people accountable. Give it back. Expect complete work. Respect natural consequences. Becoming an investor. Experiment number one, give 51% of the vote. Experiment number two, let nature take its course. Experiment number three, ask for the FIX. Experiment number four, give it back. Leveraging resources. Micromanagers. What do? They manage every detail of the work to ensure it is completed the way they would do it. And what do they get? They get people who wait to be told what to do. They get people who hold back because they expect to be interrupted and told what to do instead. They get free riders who wait for the boss to swoop in and save them. They get people who try to work their bosses and make sophisticated excuses. Investors. What do? They give other people the ownership for results and invest in their success. And what do they get? They get people who take initiative and anticipate challenges. They get people who are fully focused on achieving results. They get people who get ahead of the boss in solving problems. They get people who respond to the natural forces around them. Unexpected findings. Number one, multipliers do get involved in the operational details, but they keep the ownership with other people. Number two, multipliers are rated 42% higher at delivering world-class results than their diminisher counterparts. Chapter 7. The Accidental Diminisher. We judge others by their doings, but ourselves by our intentions. Edward Wigglesworth. While it may seem that the diminishers described in the previous chapters were tyrannical bullies and know-it-alls, it turned out that they actually weren't all jerks, and some were really good people. While the narcissistic leaders grabbed the headlines, the vast majority of diminishing happening inside our workplaces is done by the accidental diminisher. Managers with the best of intentions, good people who think they are doing a good job leading. How might we, with the very best of intentions, be having a diminishing impact on the people we lead? Can people be hindered by our honest attempts to help, teach, or lead by example? A high school was facing a critical application deadline that would determine its ranking and status as a blue ribbon school, and the responsibility fell on Sally, a veteran principal. She loved analytical work and was drawn to anything that involved data, spreadsheets, and synthesis. She dove into the briefing documents to get a thorough understanding of the analysis that would need to be done. Realizing that the project was significant and needed a lot of further analysis, she decided to get her assistant principal involved. Marcus was relatively new to his role and to spreadsheet work, but he was smart, thorough, and insightful. She decided to hand the data analysis over to him, giving him full ownership. Sally wanted him to be successful, so she carefully planned the handoff. She met with him, reviewed the report specifications with him, told him he would be in charge, and laid out clear expectations for what needed to be done. Sally then began working on other elements of the report and waited for Marcus to send the data analysis to her. When he hadn't sent it 2 days later, she suspected he was struggling and wanted to help him, so she sent him more instructions and suggested some categories to use for analyzing the data. Again, she didn't hear much from him. She stopped by his desk to see if he had finished it. He hadn't. Knowing how conscientious Marcus was, Sally assumed he needed more help. She sat down, offered her support, and asked, "How can I be of help to you with this analysis?" When she didn't get a concrete response, she began offering suggestions. "Would it help if I gave you a quick tutorial on how to use the statistics functions in Excel? Or perhaps we can sit down together and go through the data elements?" Strangely, he didn't bite on any of the offers. Sally was growing frustrated. Clearly, Marcus needed help, but she couldn't figure out how to help him. Sally was about to offer to do the first set of analysis with him, but he started to speak before she could. Sally stopped talking and gave him her full attention, thrilled to finally learn what help he needed from her. He began tentatively, holding back how irritated he was by her deluge of offers to help. But he grew more confident and finally was able to say, "Sally, I think I could use just a little less help from you." Sally sheepishly acknowledged his message, backed off, and gave him the space he needed to figure it out on his own. He did figure it out, and the analysis from this smart, conscientious assistant principal became a vital component of the report that once again earned the school blue ribbon status. Despite the best intentions, this leader had become an accidental diminisher. While her intent was to help, her help was a hindrance. What happens when a manager is too quick with ideas and too swift with action, or too supportive and helpful, or just enthusiastic or optimistic? Surely these can be character virtues, the kind taught in business school or Sunday school. Indeed they are, but many popular management practices can lead us, subtly but surely, down the slippery slope to becoming an accidental diminisher. The accidental diminisher. We all have accidental diminisher moments. The secret to the multiplier effect is knowing what your vulnerabilities are, spotting them in action, and turning these situations into multiplier moments. Let me share a few ways that really well-intended leaders end up having a diminishing impact on the people around them. As you consider each, you might ask yourself, what is my vulnerability? How might my best intentions be shutting down good ideas and smart people? The idea guy. This type of leader is a creative, innovative thinker who loves an idea-rich environment. He is a veritable fountain of ideas. Ideas bubble up for him 24/7, so he bursts into the office brimming with new ideas to share with his colleagues. This leader doesn't necessarily think his ideas are superior. He simply believes that the more he tosses around his ideas, the more he will spark ideas in others. But what actually happens around an idea guy? The ideas he tosses out seem compelling, so his team begins to chase them. But as soon as they begin to make progress on yesterday's idea, the next day brings a new idea du jour. The team makes ephemeral progress on multiple fronts. This great chase becomes a standstill as they realize they always end up back at square one. So why not just stay there? As they learn to stop acting on the leader's ideas, they also stop trying to come up with their own ideas. After all, if they actually need a new idea, they can just wait for the fountain to spew. It is easy to get idea lazy around people who are idea rich. Always on. This dynamic, charismatic leader exudes energy. He or she is always engaged, always present, and always has something to say. These are the leaders with a big personality that can fill a room. They assume that their energy is contagious, like a virus to be caught by anyone in their presence. But like the common cold, this leader can be draining. She enervates rather than energizes the people around her. As she expands like a gas, consuming all the available oxygen, others suffocate. Most find her just plain exhausting. Soon, people avoid making eye contact or having encounters with her, thinking, "I just don't have the energy right now." And all too often around this leader, thinking introverts are suppressed while action-oriented extroverts dominate. We know what the always-on leader does to others. We've all seen it and felt it. But what do others end up doing to this type of leader? Well, what do you do to the human being who lacks an off switch? If you can't find a dimmer switch, you simply turn her off inside your head. You put her in the background. She becomes white noise. Her endless spray of speech becomes muffled and sometimes completely unheard by the people she leads. The always-on leader thinks she is playing big, but actually she becomes small, and she makes everyone around her small too. Energy isn't contagious, but attitude and confidence in others are. When the leader is always on, everyone else is always off. Rescuer. He is a good manager and a decent person, the type of leader who doesn't like to see people struggle, make avoidable mistakes, or fail. At the first sign of distress, he jumps in and helps. Occasionally, he swoops in with a big heroic rescue. More often than not, he simply lends a hand, resolves a problem, and helps people across the finish line. Incidentally, we find that this is the most common way leaders accidentally diminish. The intent of the rescuer is noble. He wants to see other people be successful. He desires to protect the reputation of the people who work for him. But because he interrupts a natural performance cycle, he starves people of the vital learning they need to be successful. When a manager helps too soon and too often, people around him become dependent and helpless. Instead of feeling successful, employees experience frustration and depleted confidence when they fail to cross the finish line. Yes, there are times when employees appear to appreciate the help, yet the behavior is nonetheless diminishing. While they may feel relief, they haven't grown or even fully utilized the intelligence they have. Furthermore, when the rescuer intervenes, he can create a vexing and all too pervasive performance disconnect by depriving people of the feedback that comes from the natural consequences of mistakes. While the manager sees failure and a gap they have to step in and close, employees often see success. You can hardly blame the employees for this delusion. After all, their work always crosses the finish line on time, because they are helped by the invisible hand of the rescuer. As leaders, sometimes we are most helpful when we don't help. Pace setter. This is the achievement-oriented leader who leads by example. To build momentum, she personally sets the standard for performance and for exemplifying the values of the organization, such as quality, customer service, innovation, etc. She takes the lead, sets the pace, and expects that the people around her will notice, follow, and, of course, catch up. For example, a manager might wish to send a strong message that customer service is a top priority. So she increases the time she spends in the field, traveling to customer sites, meeting with key clients, and writing up and distributing trip reports. Her intention is to send a signal that her organization should be actively listening for the voice of the customer. But what actually happens when the leader speeds out ahead? Do others pick up the pace, or do they fall behind? The effect is subtle. The leader is half right. People do take notice. They catch on, but they rarely catch up. Instead of increasing their own pace, they most often assume the role of spectator, watching the pace setter do her thing. While she is expecting her staff to speed up, they are actually slowing down or sitting down. Instead of initiating customer contact themselves, they assume that this is an executive role and sit back and read the reports. Or perhaps, recognizing the widening gap between the pace setter and themselves, they simply give up. I've seen this dynamic many times in the workplace, but I've learned it most poignantly in a foot race against an 8-year-old. For most of his second grade year in school, my son Joshua insisted we race to the bus stop each day. Like any good parent, I understood the purpose of these races to be that of encouraging his budding love of sport and competition, so I made sure to let him win or make it a close, rousing competition. But every now and then I would forget. I too love to run and enjoy the feeling of turning it on and crossing the finish line first, or maybe just not last. Josh was my youngest child, and at this point, he was the only child I could still beat on foot. Fueled by some sudden vain ambition, i.e. midlife crisis, occasionally I would take off running at full speed and easily beat him to the bus stop. Catching my breath and looking back, I would see that he had stopped running and was now walking. This seemed strange because he loved to race. As he walked closer, the look on his face was a muddle of disappointment and disapproval. When he arrived at the bus stop, he would shrug his shoulders and say indifferently, "We weren't racing that time." Every time I lost my head and raced out in front, creating a gap too big for him to close, the same scene ensued. He had learned that when he couldn't keep up, it was best to just let me win. As leaders, sometimes the faster we run, the slower others walk. When leaders set the pace, they're more likely to create spectators than followers. Rapid responder. What about the leader who's quick to take action? This is the leader who prizes agility and fast turnaround. He takes responsibility and is on it. He's quick to respond, troubleshoot problems, and make fast micro decisions. Most of us work with some sort of rapid responder. He sees a problem, he solves it. He sees a bear, he shoots it. Emails don't last long in his inbox. He opens, reads, and resolves immediately. His intent is noble, of course. He wants an agile organization that can pounce on problems and responds rapidly to stakeholders. But instead of agility, the rapid responder tends to generate low-grade apathy. Even the best employees are slow to respond when they know that someone else is already on it. Consider what happens when an urgent email hits an employee's inbox. She opens the email and recognizes its importance. She sees that her boss is copied on it, but the issue falls in her area of responsibility, so she jumps on it. She rereads it carefully and thoughtfully contemplates the options. She realizes that she needs more information and consults a colleague. When the employee returns to draft her reply, she notices she has new mail and gets that sinking feeling that her boss may have already responded in the interim. And of course he has. Not wanting to get out of sync, she just lets it go. When this happens frequently enough, employees learn to just let the boss deal with the issue, even when the issue at hand was actually theirs to handle. Not only is the rapid responder the first one and the only one to respond, this boss is the only one growing. The rapid responder can create activity traffic jams across his organization. Because he responds to problems and questions quickly, he releases a lot of decisions into the workflow of his team. The roads become flooded with decisions, and as those decisions prompt an excess of action, people move at a crawl, and soon it is full-fledged gridlock. The leader reacts quickly, but the people around him tend to react slowly, if at all. Optimist. This positive, can-do manager always sees possibilities and believes that most problems can be tackled with hard work and the right mindset. She's read the research on the power of positive thinking and the incredible mental and physical benefits of optimism. She is a glass-half-full kind of person. The optimist isn't necessarily a cheerleader. She just focuses on what is possible and believes that the people around her, herself included, are smart and can figure it out. So how could this possibly be diminishing? A colleague and I were in the middle of a high-stakes research project where we had a small window of opportunity to write an article for a prestigious academic publication. To pull this off, we needed to complete some complex analysis, do a round of additional research, and actually write the article, all while working on several other projects and operating on a thin budget. After years of experience in the corporate world where a given week involved juggling knives, pulling rabbits out of a hat, and rubbing two nickels together to pay for it all, to me, this seemed feasible and an interesting challenge. I enthusiastically attacked the project, providing leadership along the way to my more junior colleague. At one critical meeting, he turned to me and said, "Liz, I need you to stop saying that." "Saying what?" I asked. He replied, "How hard can it be?" I looked puzzled. He explained, "You say that all the time. How hard can it be? We can do this. After all, how hard can it be?" I could see his point emerging. While I was working for Oracle, a rapidly growing company, I had been thrown into management at the tender age of 24 and faced a steady onslaught of challenges for which I was untrained and underprepared. These formative experiences taught me that a team of smart, driven people could do almost anything. And I learned to say to myself, "I can do this, after all. How hard can it be?" This attitude, termed a growth mindset by Dr. Carol Dweck, had worked beautifully for me and many of my colleagues over the years. My current colleague's voice reeled me back from my reflection. "Yes, that is what I need you to stop saying," he said. "But why?" I probed. He paused and looked me straight in the eye and said, "Because what we are doing is actually really hard." After another deliberate pause, he continued, "And I need you to acknowledge that." He wasn't opposed to the idea that it was doable. He simply wanted me to acknowledge the challenge and recognize his struggle. He didn't want me glossing over the challenge with my optimism. Having heard his sincere message, I looked at him squarely and acknowledged, "Yes, what we are doing is hard. It is really, really difficult. I suppose I just meant that we are very capable and I'm confident that we'll figure this out." I could see the tension lifting. I assured him that I would do my best to stop saying that thing. Meanwhile, in the back of my mind, I told myself, "Sure, I can stop saying that. After all, how hard can it be?" Is it possible that a can-do attitude that worked so well for you in a previous role might be working against you as a leader? When you play the role of optimist, you undervalue the struggle the team is experiencing and the hard-fought learning and work. Your staff may wonder if you've lost your tether to reality. Or worse, you might be sending an unintentional message that mistakes and failure are not an option. After all, how hard can it be? When the leader sees only the upside, others can become preoccupied with the downside. Protector. It's easy for a well-intended manager to fall into the mama bear trap and become the protector who shields his or her staff, buffering people from the hazards of corporate life, the way the grizzly female protects her offspring from predators. Whereas the rescuer saves the day after problems arise, the aim of the protector is simply to keep his people safe and unscathed, not even seeing the problems. He worries that if team members get entangled in ugly politics, they might be eaten alive, so he fights off bullies and shields his staff from nasty internal politics. Often managers have a better understanding of the darker forces that exist inside the organization, and they assume that this is their burden to bear. The protector worries that if his people are exposed to the harsh reality, they might become tainted or disillusioned and decide to leave for greener pastures. So he keeps his staff out of the most contentious meetings with senior executives, knowing these encounters can be career limiting. He shields people from the brutal facts and steers his team clear of danger and creates a seemingly safe haven, a happy valley where his people can flourish. While certainly there are situations when wise managers should shield their team, it can become a dangerous practice itself. Unfortunately, the mama bear can prevent staff from learning from hardship and taking full accountability. It is a misguided attempt to manufacture safety. We know that multipliers create intellectual safety, where people are free to express their ideas, but they don't shield people from reality, and they don't necessarily remove obstacles for people. In fact, with the assumption that people are smart and will figure it out, a multiplier is inclined to expose people to such toxins and challenges, hoping that they will build resistance and strength. If the leader continually protects people from danger, they never learn to fend for themselves. Strategist. The strategist is the big thinker who casts a compelling vision of the future. She shows the team a better place, a destination worth striving for, and she sells it with evangelical zeal. The strategist thinks she is generating energy and the momentum needed to escape the gravitational pull of the status quo. Certainly, a wise leader knows how crucial it is to provide the big picture, the context, the why behind what the team is doing, and it is. But sometimes, a strategic, visionary leader can go too far and be too prescriptive. She might not be leaving enough space for others to think through the challenges themselves and generate the intellectual muscle needed to make a vision a reality. People can spend their time second-guessing what the boss wants rather than finding answers themselves. Instead of running with it, people climb up the mountaintop to seek guidance from the guru. This leader would generate more movement by seeding a challenge rather than selling a big vision. If you've built a reputation as a big thinker, don't be surprised if people save the big thinking for you. Perfectionist. We all know the leader with perfectionist tendencies. He appreciates excellence and loves the feeling of getting something perfect. He goes beyond setting a high standard for others to follow, as does the pace setter, and wants everyone around him to have the satisfaction of getting it just exactly right. So he offers helpful critiques and points out little mistakes and flaws, the way a homeowner might use blue construction tape to mark the slightest imperfections in a home improvement project. A drip of paint here, a stray exposed nail head there, so the builder can fix the mistakes, work down the punch list, and enjoy pride of craftsmanship. While he is offering these suggestions for improvement, he is envisioning a masterpiece in the making, an A-plus grade on an important assignment. He knows that excellence doesn't come in one fell swoop, but in back-and-forth iteration. But while he sees an A-plus in progress, others see nothing but red marks and blue tape all over their work. They see blood and loss and can easily become disengaged and disheartened. Sometimes a 90% solution, executed with 100% ownership, is better than getting it 100% right with a disengaged team. The previous examples show just a few of the ways that well-intended leaders can have a diminishing effect. As you listened to the various accidental diminisher profiles I just described, surely some resonated, giving you a sharp insight or maybe even a pang of guilt. The question isn't which one of these is your vulnerability. The real question is, how do you discover your areas of vulnerability? You can bring this vague suspicion into sharper focus by taking our online quiz called Are You an Accidental Diminisher? At www.multipliersbooks.com. This 3-minute quiz provides additional structure to help you self-assess and analyze your potentially diminishing habits. Are you an accidental diminisher? I should clarify, having any of these tendencies does not make you a diminisher. It simply increases the likelihood that you will have a diminishing impact. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you have a diminishing impact, you are likely to be completely unaware of it and probably the last to know. As a leader, how do you know whether you are having a diminishing effect despite having the best intentions? How do you increase your self-awareness? Formulating and recording your own insights is a reasonable first step, but you'll learn more by asking the people you lead to share their insights. Several years ago, I was teaching a multipliers workshop in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. The room was full of men in the beautiful white robes and headpieces known as kendurs. I was on high alert, knowing the ideas were perhaps unconventional and that the way I was teaching was probably violating cultural norms. But the group was delightfully engaged and enjoying the session. I asked each person to write down one way he or she might be accidentally diminishing. They did. I then asked them to share their insight with their colleagues at the table. They hesitated for a moment, but then did. This was a huge relief, so I sat down to collect my thoughts. A couple minutes later, I looked up and noticed that the exercise was not proceeding as planned. There was a swirl of white kanduras, and I could see that people were getting up and moving around. Immediately, I assumed that the participants were opting out of the exercise and conducting other business instead. Concerned, I moved closer to observe and then asked Khalid, a warm and perceptive Emirati national, to help me understand what was happening. He responded, We were sharing our own observations, but then we realized we really should be asking our colleagues to tell us how we are accidentally diminishing. We're moving into new groups so we can get feedback from the people we work with most closely. I watched in fascination as individuals moved energetically around the room, scurrying to find a small group or partner who could give them honest feedback. This leadership team understood that self-awareness as a leader comes from understanding the perspectives of those we lead and serve, those who are the customers of our leadership. Our learning can start with our own insight, but it can't end there. As you seek to get feedback from others, you can use a 360-degree assessment to get unfiltered feedback. See multipliersbooks.com. But you can also do it the old-fashioned way, by asking good, honest, face-to-face questions. Here are some questions you might use to elicit this feedback. Number one, how might I be shutting down the ideas and actions of others despite having the best of intentions? Number two, what am I inadvertently doing that might be having a diminishing impact on others? Number three, how might my intentions be interpreted differently by others? What messages might my actions actually be conveying? Number four, what could I do differently? Hazel Jackson, co-founder and CEO of a consultancy in Dubai, includes this question in each of the performance check-ins with her employees. How might I be diminishing you? She then listens and adjusts. You can get feedback through a formal tool or through a casual conversation or a regular check-in. Either way, what is critical is that you get new information to raise your self-awareness and recalibrate your approach. To become intentional multipliers, we must understand how our best intentions can be translated and received differently by others. Leading with intention. Leading with intention starts with understanding how our natural tendencies can take us down the wrong path, how great habits and seemingly strong leadership traits can go awry and become our vulnerability. John C. Maxwell, the leadership author, coach, and speaker, is an undeniable leadership genius. His 105 books, including 13 bestsellers, have sold more than 26 million copies. Not only does he teach leadership, he's a dedicated practitioner as well. He's built 5 successful companies and has personally mentored hundreds, if not thousands, of other leaders. When John first heard the idea of leader as multiplier, it struck a chord with him. Every one of the ideals and practices of multipliers resonated with what he had practiced as a leader. However, the idea of the accidental diminisher gave him pause. An avid learner, as he listened to the diminisher qualities, he recognized he had all of those too, and he realized that some of his natural strengths might be having a negative effect on his team. John identified his blind spots and diminishing tendencies, especially as pace setter, optimist, and rescuer. John set a 1-year goal to adjust his intentions and resist his diminishing effect as a leader. He started by better understanding how his best intentions as a leader might be accidentally diminishing his team and sought feedback from his inner circle, particularly from Mark Cole, the CEO who runs his 5 companies. The conversation was made possible by the trust they had built over many years of working and growing together. Mark and others helped John see that while he was often needed to hit home runs for the team, he didn't need to go to bat for his players as often as he had been. John, a sports fan, could see his vulnerability. He believes that everything rises and falls on leadership, so it is hard for him to stand back and let one of his players strike out. He started to use an idea he got from Glenn Jackson, co-founder of Jackson Spalding. In baseball, a 3-2 count is called a full count, meaning that just one more strike will cause the player to strike out and have no more opportunities to get on base and score. John said, "When the count is 3-2, my natural tendency is to step in and take the last swing." John and his team developed a code. When a project seemed to be in jeopardy, Mark or another trusted colleague would say, "The count is still 3-1. The message was clear. The team member was indeed struggling, but was not yet in danger of striking out. John could stand back a little longer. For example, one of John's leaders started creating a new business line. That's not unusual because John is very entrepreneurial. So is his team. However, this particular business wasn't right for John. It didn't fit his vision. John's natural inclination would have been to jump in and address the issue. Instead, he allowed Mark Cole to address it in the way he wanted to. John backed off and allowed Mark to take leadership on the issue, and he worked it out effectively. John realized that when he held back, it didn't express indifference, but rather a vote of confidence in his player at bat. Mark said, "John allowed me to handle it with my solution and in my timing. It actually worked out very well and gave me greater credibility with the leader. And we were able to get that leader's area back on track." Later, John reflected, "Learning about diminishers and working with my own diminishing tendencies has been one of the most important things I've done for my growth in the last year. This leader, who has developed millions of other leaders, is able to do so because he never stops developing himself." To lead on purpose, we must understand how we diminish by accident. How might you be accidentally diminishing? How can you see what you alone can't see? Even the best leaders have blind spots. Once you identify yours, you can work with your team to develop a set of signals and workarounds. Having a set of common signals will help you spot and avoid diminisher bait. The workarounds will then help you turn these would-be diminishing episodes into multiplier moments. The list at the end of the chapter offers strategies to develop these new practices. You might try one of the multiplier experiments found in Appendix E in the included PDF, or you might try a simple workaround that you can use in the moment. These include abiding by a simple rule of thumb like wait 24 hours before responding to emails if you want others to respond, or creating a filter like if you don't want anyone to take action on an idea, don't share it. As one aspiring multiplier said, "I can't control the ideas that pop into my head, but I can control the ones that come out of my mouth." Do less and challenge more. Becoming a multiplier often starts with becoming less of a diminisher. And this usually means doing less, less talking, less responding, less convincing, and less rescuing of others who need to struggle and learn for themselves. By doing less, we can become more of a multiplier. Doing less to achieve more is one of many examples where counterintuition is more instructive than intuition. When no one else is speaking up, the compelling inclination is to jump in and fill the void. But we become a multiplier when we learn to hold back and allow silence to draw others in. When we feel the need to be big, let it be a signal that we need to be small and dispense our views in small but intense doses. And when our instincts tell us to help more, we might need to help less. Becoming a multiplier requires us to understand how our most noble intentions can have a diminishing effect, sometimes deeply so. American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr said, "All human sin seems so much worse in its consequences than in its intentions." Likewise, while leaders view their own leadership through the lens of their positive intentions, their staff perceives that same behavior only by its negative consequences. By learning to do less and challenge more, we can transform ourselves from accidental diminisher to intentional multiplier. Tendency number one, the idea guy. Their intention? For their ideas to stimulate ideas in others. The outcome? They overwhelm others who shut down or spend time chasing the idea du jour. Here's a simple workaround. Create a holding tank. Before sharing new ideas, Stop and ask yourself if you want the people who work for you to take action now. If not, hold off sharing and save it for later. Try these learning experiments. Extreme questions, make a debate. Tendency number two, always on. Their intention? To create infectious energy and share their point of view. The outcome? They consume all the space and others tune them out. Here's a simple workaround. Say it just once. Instead of repeating yourself for emphasis, try saying things once and create a reason for others to chime in and build on the idea. Set expectations for others to speak up. Try these learning experiments. Play fewer chips. Give 51% of the vote. Tendency number three, rescuer. Their intention? To ensure people are successful and protect their reputation. The outcome? People become dependent, which weakens their reputation. Here's a simple workaround. Ask for their FIX. When someone brings you a problem or signals a need for help, remind yourself that he or she probably already has a solution. Ask, how do you think we should solve it? Try these learning experiments. Make space for mistakes. Give it back. Tendency number four, pace setter. Their intention? To set a high standard for quality or pace. The outcome? Others become spectators or give up when they can't keep up. Here's a simple workaround. Stay within sight. If you have a tendency to pull out ahead, remind yourself to stay within sight so people don't give up or get lost. Stay within a distance that someone could catch up. Try this learning experiment. Give 51% of the vote. Tendency number five, rapid responder. Their intention? To keep their organization moving fast. The outcome? Their organization moves slowly because of the traffic jam of too many decisions or changes. Here's a simple workaround. Set a mandatory waiting period. Wait 24 hours, or however many, before responding to any email that falls into someone else's job. Give that person the first right of response. Try these learning experiments. Extreme questions. Make a debate. Tendency number six, optimist. Their intention? To create belief that the team can do it. The outcome? People wonder if they appreciate the struggle and the possibility of failure. Here's a simple workaround. Signal the struggle. Before offering your boundless enthusiasm, start by acknowledging how hard the work is. Let people know, what I'm asking you to do is hard. Success isn't guaranteed. Try these learning experiments. Make space for mistakes. Talk up your mistakes. Tendency number seven, protector. Their intention? To keep people safe from political forces in the organization. The outcome? People don't learn to fend for themselves. Here's a simple workaround. Expose and inoculate. Expose your team members to harsh realities in small doses so they can learn from their mistakes and develop strength. Try this learning experiment. Make space for mistakes. Tendency number eight, strategist. Their intention? To create a compelling reason to move beyond the status quo. The outcome? People defer up and second-guess the boss rather than finding answers. Here's a simple workaround. Don't complete the puzzle. As you paint a picture of the future, leave sections for your team to complete. Frame the puzzle by establishing the why and the what, but let your team fill in the how. Try these experiments. Lay a concrete challenge. Ask the questions. Tendency number nine. Perfectionist. Their intention? To help people produce outstanding work they are proud of. The outcome? People feel criticized, become disheartened, and stop trying. Here's a simple workaround. Define the standards. Define the standards of excellence up front. Let people know what outstanding looks like and define the criteria for completeness. Ask people to self-assess by the standards. Try these learning experiments. Make space for mistakes. give 51% of the vote. All of the learning experiments can be found in Appendix E in the included PDF. Chapter 7 Summary.